weren't, "We'll beat this," or, "Oh, fuck." But, "Jules, I love you so much." That was all she needed to know. "Love wins," I say, referencing a story Julie once told me about the time her parents went through a rough patch and separated for 5 days when Julie was 12. By the weekend, they were back together, and when she and her sister asked why, her father looked at her mother with such affection and said, "Because at the end of the day, love wins. Always remember that, girls." Julie nods. Love wins. "If I write this book," she says, "maybe I'll say that the best responses I've gotten have been from people who were genuine and didn't edit themselves." She looks at me. "Like you." I try to remember what I'd said when Julie told me she was dying. I remember feeling uncomfortable the first time, devastated the second. I asked Julie what she remembers me saying. She smiles. "Both times you said the same thing, and I'll never forget it, because I wasn't expecting that from a therapist." I shake my head. "Expecting what?" "You spontaneously said in this quiet, sad voice, 'Oh, Julie,' which was the perfect response. But it's what you didn't say that meant the most. You teared up, but I figured that you didn't want me to see it, so I didn't say anything." The memory takes shape in my mind. "I'm glad that you saw my tears, and you could have said something. I hope from now on you will." "Well, now I would. I mean, now that we've done my obituary together, I think I'm pretty much an open book." A few weeks ago, Julie finished writing her obituary. We were in the midst of some important conversations at the time, talking about how she wanted to die. Who did she want with her? Where did she want to be? What would she want for comfort? What was she afraid of? What kind of memorial service or funeral did she want? What did she want people to know and when? Even as she'd discovered hidden parts of herself since the cancer diagnosis, more spontaneity, more flexibility, she was still, at heart, a planner. And if she was going to have to contend with her early death sentence, she would do as much of it as she could the way she wanted. In considering her obituary, we talked about what meant the most to her. There was her professional success and her passion for her research and her students. There was her Saturday morning home at Trader Joe's and the sense of freedom she found there. There was Emma, who, with Julie's help in the financial aid application process, was able to cut down her hours at Trader Joe's so that she could attend college. There were the friends she had run marathons with, and the ones she did book club with. At the top of the list was her husband. "The best person in the world to go through life with," she said, "but also the best to go through death with." Her sister and her nephew and newborn niece. Julie was their godmother. There were her parents and four grandparents, all of whom couldn't understand how in a family with such longevity, Julie was dying so young. "It's like we've done therapy on steroids," Julie said of everything that had happened since we met. "Like the way Matt and I say that we're doing our marriage on steroids. We have to cram it all in as quickly as possible." Julie realized when she talked about cramming it all in, that if she was pissed off about having such a short life, it was only because it had been such a good one. Which is why, in the end, after several drafts and revisions, Julie decided to keep her obituary simple. For every single day of her 35 years, she wanted it to read, "Julie Callahan Blue was loved. Love wins." Chapter 44, Boyfriend's Email. I'm at my desk, working on my happiness book, slogging through another chapter. I motivate myself with this thought. If I turn in this book, next time I'll get to write something that matters. Whatever that is. The sooner I finish this, the sooner I can get myself back on fresh ground. Whatever that is. I'm embracing uncertainty, and I'm actually writing the book. My friend Jen calls, but I don't pick up. Recently, I've filled her in on the missing parts of my health situation. And she's been helpful in the way Wendell has, not by finding a diagnosis, but by helping me cope with a lack of one. I've been learning how to be okay with not being totally okay, while also arranging consults with specialists who might take my condition more seriously. No more wandering uterus doctors for me. Right now, though, I have to finish this chapter. I've blocked out 2 hours to write. I type words and they appear on my screen, filling up page after page. I knock out the chapter the way my son does the occasional busy work at school. Workmanlike, as the means to an end. I keep going until I get to the chapter's last line, then I give myself a reward. I can check email and call Jen. I'll take a 15-minute break before moving ahead to the next chapter. The end is in sight, just one final section to go. I'm chatting with Jen and scanning my emails, when suddenly I gasp. In bold letters, boyfriend's name appears in my box. I'm amazed. I haven't heard from boyfriend in 8 months, ever since I tried to get answers and brought pages of notes from those calls to Wendell's office. "Open it," Jen says when I tell her. But I just stare at boyfriend's name. My stomach tightens, though in a different way than it did when I kept hoping he'd change his mind. It tightens because even if he were to say he's had some sort of epiphany and wants to be together after all, I would without question say no. My gut is telling me two things: that I don't want to be with him anymore, and that, even so, the memory of what happened still stings. Whatever he has to say, it might upset me, and I don't want to get sidetracked by this right now. I have to finish this book I care nothing about so I can write something I do care about. Maybe, I tell Jen. I'll read boyfriend's email after I crank out another chapter. Then send it to me and I'll read it, she says. You can't make me wait like this. I laugh. Fine. For you, I'll open it. The email is shocking and predictable at the same time. You won't believe who I ran into today. Lee. She just joined the firm. I read it to Jen. Lee is someone that boyfriend and I both know independently and secretly find irritating. If we were still dating, of course he'd share this juicy piece of news. But now? It's so out of context, so devoid of acknowledgement of what happened between us and where our conversations left off. It feels as though boyfriend still has his head in the sand, and I'm poking mine out. That's it? Jen asks. That's all the kid hater has to say? She goes silent, waiting for my reaction. I can't help it. I'm thrilled. To me, his email is reassuringly poetic. A beautiful summary of everything I've discovered about avoidance in Wendell's office. It even reads like a haiku. 3 lines of 5, 7, and 5 syllables, respectively. You won't believe who I ran into today, Lee. She just joined the firm. But Jen's not amused. She's furious. No matter what I've told her about my role in our breakup, that while boyfriend could have been more upfront with himself and with me early on, I could have been more upfront with myself and with him about what I wanted, what I was hiding from, and whether we were really a match after all. She still thinks he's an asshole. I remember trying to convince Wendell that boyfriend was an asshole. Nowadays, I find myself trying to convince everyone else that he's not. What does that even mean? Jen asks about the email. How about, how are you doing? Is he really that emotionally stunted? It means nothing, I say. It's meaningless. There's no point in trying to analyze it, to give it meaning. Jen is outraged. But I'm surprised to find that I'm not upset by this after all. Instead, I'm relieved. My gut unclenches. You're not going to respond to this, I hope, Jen says. But I almost want to thank boyfriend for breaking up with me and not wasting even more of my time. Maybe his email did have meaning, or at least my receiving it on this particular day had meaning for me. I tell Jen I have to get back to writing my book. But after we hang up, that's not what I do. Nor do I write boyfriend back. Just as I don't want a meaningless relationship, I don't want to write a meaningless book, even though by now I'm 3/4 done. If death and meaninglessness are ultimate concerns, it makes sense that this book I care little about has plagued me, and also that I turned down the lucrative parenting book before that. Though I didn't fully acknowledge my failing body back then, somewhere in my cells, I must have become aware that my time was limited, so how I spent it would matter. I remember my conversation with Julie, and another thought occurs to me now. When I die, I don't want to leave behind my equivalent of boyfriend's email. For a while, I've thought that walking around those prison bars meant finishing the book so that I could keep my advance and have the opportunity to write another. But boyfriend's email makes me wonder if I'm still shaking those same bars. Wendell has helped me to let go of the story that everything would have worked out for me if I'd married boyfriend. And there's no point in holding on to the parallel story that the parenting book would have made everything work out for me too. Both are fantasies. Certain things would have been different, sure. Ultimately, though, I'd still be itching for meaning, for something deeper. Just like I am now with this stupid happiness book that my agent says I have to write for all kinds of practical reasons. But what if that story's wrong too? What if I don't, in fact, have to write this book that my agent says I must or face disaster? On some level, I suspect I've known this answer for a while. And now, all of a sudden, I know it in a different way. I think about Charlotte and the stages of change. I'm ready, I decide, for action. I place my fingers on the keyboard again, this time to type a letter to my editor at the publishing house. I want to cancel my contract. After a brief hesitation, I take a deep breath, then push send, and off it goes. My truth, finally, hurtling through cyberspace. Chapter 45. Wendell's beard. It's a sunny Los Angeles day, and I'm in a good mood as I park my car across the street from Wendell's office. I almost hate being in too good of a mood on therapy days. What's there to talk about? Actually, I know better. It turns out that sessions to which patients come with neither a crisis nor an agenda tend to be the most revelatory ones. When we give our minds space to wander, they take us on the most unexpected and interesting places. As I cross from the parking lot to Wendell's building, I hear a song blasting from someone's car. Imagine Dragons, On Top of the World. Walking down the corridor to Wendell's office, I start humming along. But as soon as I open the door to the waiting room, I go silent, confused. Whoops, this isn't Wendell's waiting room. Caught up in the song, I'd opened the wrong door. I laugh at my mistake. I walk out and shut the door, then look around to get my bearings. I check the nameplate on the door, which confirms that I am indeed in the right place. Once more, I open the door, but what I see looks nothing like the room I know. For a moment, I panic, as if in a dream. Where am I? Wendell's waiting room has been completely transformed. There's new paint, new flooring, new furniture, and new art. Striking black and white photos. Gone are what I assume to be the hand-me-downs from his parents' house. Gone is the vase with the cheesy fake flowers, and in its place is a ceramic pitcher and cups for water. The only thing that remains is the noise machine that ensures no one can hear what's being said on the other side of the wall. It feels like I've walked into the finished product on one of those home improvement shows where a space becomes unrecognizable from its original unfortunate state. I want to ooh and ah the way the owners do on these shows. It looks beautiful, simple and uncluttered, and also a bit quirky, like Wendell. My usual chair is gone, so I take a seat in one of the new ones with funky steel legs and a leather back. I haven't seen Wendell for 2 weeks. I'd assumed his being out of the office meant that he was on vacation, maybe even at the cabin from his childhood with his large extended family. I had imagined all of his siblings and nieces and nephews I'd discovered online, and tried to picture Wendell with them, goofing around with his kids or kicking back with a beer by the lake. By now I realized that this renovation was also taking place. My good mood is dissipating, and I start to question if my contentment was real or if I was experiencing a flight to health in Wendell's absence. A flight to health is a phenomenon in which patients convince themselves that they're suddenly over their issues because, unbeknownst to them, They can't tolerate the anxiety that working through these issues is bringing up. Typically, a patient might have a difficult session about a childhood trauma, then come in the next week and announce that therapy is no longer needed. I feel great. That session was cathartic. A flight to health is especially common when the therapist or patient has been away, and in that break, the person's unconscious defenses take hold. I did so well the past few weeks, I don't think I need therapy anymore. Sometimes this change is genuine. Other times, patients abruptly leave, only to come back. Flight to health or not, I'm feeling disoriented. Despite the room's vast improvement, I sort of miss the old crappy furniture, much the way I've felt about the inner transformations I've been going through. Wendell was the makeover show that came in and launched my internal renovation. And while I feel so much better now, in the during, because unlike decor makeovers, there's no such thing as after until we're dead, sometimes I think of the before with a weird kind of nostalgia. I wouldn't want it back, but I'm glad I remember it. I hear the click of Wendell's office door, and then his footsteps on the new maple floors as he walks out to greet me. I look up and do another double take. Before, I didn't recognize his waiting room, and now I almost don't recognize Wendell. It's like somebody's playing a prank on me. Surprise, just kidding. In his 2 weeks off, he has grown a beard. He's also ditched the cardigan for a smart brown button-down, traded his worn loafers for the same trendy slip-ons John wears, and looks like a completely different person. Hi, he says as usual. Wow, I say a little too loudly. So many changes. I gesture to the waiting room, but I'm staring at his beard. Now you really look like a therapist, I add as I stand up, making a joke to cover my shock. In fact, his beard looks nothing like those stodgy ones in the long tradition of well-known therapists. Wendell's beard is stylish, scruffy, unkempt, rakish. He looks attractive? I remember my earlier denial of any romantic transference with him. And I'd been truthful, as far as I was aware. But why was I so profoundly uncomfortable right now? Had my unconscious been having a passionate affair with Wendell behind my back? I step toward his office, but stop short at the doorway. His therapy room has also been redone. The layout is the same. The L-shaped couch configuration, the desk, the armoire, the bookshelf, the table with the tissues. But the paint, flooring, rug, art, sofas, and pillows have all changed. It looks amazing. Stunning, gorgeous. The office, I mean. The office looks gorgeous. Did you use a decorator? I ask. And he says he did. I figured. If the earlier furniture was his doing, he clearly needed a professional for this. Still, it fits Wendell perfectly. The new Wendell. The spruced up but still unpretentious Wendell. I go to position B, examine the new pillows, and arrange them behind my back on the new couch. I remember how unnerved I felt the first time I sat this close to Wendell. How it seemed too close, too exposed. Now it feels that way again. What if I'm attracted to Wendell? My attraction wouldn't be uncommon. After all, if people find themselves attracted to their colleagues, friends, spouses, and a variety of men and women they see or meet in the course of a day, why not their therapists? Especially their therapists. Sexual feelings abound in therapy, and how could they not? It's easy to conflate the intimate experience of romance or sex with the intimate experience of having somebody pay undivided attention to the details of your life, accept you fully, support you without competing agendas, and know you so deeply. Some patients even flirt overtly, often unaware of ulterior motives, throwing the therapist off balance, deflecting from difficult topics, regaining power if feeling powerless, repaying the therapist in the only way the patient knows how to given his or her history. Other patients don't flirt, but vehemently deny any attraction, like John telling me that I wasn't the kind of person he'd choose as his mistress, no offense. But John often took note of my appearance. Now you're looking more like a real mistress, when I got highlights in my hair. You better watch out. Some people might see some cleavage. when I wore a V-neck blouse. Are those your fuck-me shoes for after work? When I wore heels. Each time, I'd try to talk about his jokes and the feelings underlying them. And now here I am, making a stupid joke with Wendell and smiling dumbly. He asks if I'm having a reaction to his beard. I'm just not used to it, I say. But it looks good on you. You should keep it. Or maybe you shouldn't, I think. Maybe I'll be too distracted. He raises his right eyebrow, and I notice that his eyes look different today. Brighter? And did he always have that dimple? What's going on? I'm asking because how you respond to me is related to how you respond to men. You're not a man, I interrupt, laughing. I'm not? No, I say. Wendell feigns surprise. Well, last time I checked. Right, but you know what I mean. You're not a man. You're not a guy. You're a therapist. I realize with horror that I sound just like John again. A few months earlier, I found myself struggling to dance at a wedding because of some muscle weakness in my left foot from this mysterious medical condition. At the following week's session, I told Wendell how sad I had been watching everyone else dancing. Wendell replied that I could still dance with my good foot. I just needed a partner. Well, I said, isn't the loss of a partner how I landed here in the first place? But Wendell didn't mean a romantic partner. He said I could ask anyone, that I could lean on people if I needed support, dancing or otherwise. I can't just ask anyone, I insisted. Why not? I rolled my eyes. You can ask me, he said, shrugging. I'm a good dancer, you know. He added that he'd studied dance seriously while growing up. Really? What kind of dance? I didn't know if he was kidding. I tried to picture gawky Wendell dancing. I imagined him getting all tangled up and tripping. Ballet, he said without a trace of embarrassment. Ballet? But I can do any kind of dance, he continued, smiling at my incredulity. I also do swing, modern. What would you like to dance to? No way, I said. I'm not dancing with my therapist. I wasn't concerned that he was being sexually suggestive or creepy. I knew that he had no intention of that. It was more that I didn't want to use my therapy time that way. I had things to talk about, like how I was coping with my medical condition. But part of me also knew that this was just an excuse I was giving myself, that this intervention could be useful, that the movement of dance allows our bodies to express our emotions in a way that words sometimes can't. When we dance, we express our buried feelings, talking through our bodies instead of our minds. And that can help us get out of our heads and to a new level of awareness. That's partly what dance therapy is about. It's another technique some therapists use. But still, no. I'm your therapist and a guy, Wendell says today, adding that we all interact with people in different ways based on any number of things we notice about them. Political correctness aside, we aren't emotionally blind to qualities like appearance, wardrobe, gender, race, ethnicity, or age. That's the way transference works. If my therapist were a woman, he says, I'd react to her based on the ways I relate to women. If Wendell were short, I'd react to him as somebody who's short rather than tall if... As he talks, I can't stop staring at the new him, trying to make the adjustment. It occurs to me that it wasn't just that I hadn't been attracted to Wendell earlier. It was that I hadn't been attracted to anyone. I was grieving. And it's only upon my gradual emergence that I've begun to feel attraction in the world again. Sometimes when a new patient comes in, I ask not just, what brings you here, but what brings you here now? The now is the key. Why this year, this month, this day, have you decided to come talk to me? It seemed like the breakup was my answer to, why now? But underneath it was my stuckness and my grief. I wish I could stop crying, I told Wendell early on, when I felt like a human fire hydrant. But Wendell saw it differently. He'd given me permission to feel, and also a reminder that, like so many people, I'd been mistaking feeling less for feeling better. The feelings are still there, though. They come out in unconscious behaviors, in an inability to sit still, in a mind that hungers for the next distraction, in a lack of appetite or a struggle to control one's appetite, in a short-temperedness or, in boyfriend's case, in a foot that twitched under the covers as we sat in that heavy silence under which lay the feeling that he'd kept to himself for months. Whatever he wanted, it wasn't me. And still, people try to suppress their feelings. Just a week before, a patient had told me that she couldn't go on a single night without turning on her TV, falling asleep to it, and waking up hours later. "Where did my evening go?" she asked from my couch. But the real question was, where had her feelings gone? Another patient recently lamented, "Wouldn't it be nice to be one of those people who doesn't overthink anything, who just goes with the flow, who lives the unexamined life?" I remember saying that there was a difference between examining and dwelling. And if we're cut off from our feelings, just skating on the surface, we don't get peace or joy. We get deadness. So it's not that I'm in love with Wendell. The fact that I'm finally noticing him, not just as a therapist, but as a man, is simply evidence that our work together has helped me rejoin the human race. I feel attraction again. I've even begun dating, dipping my toe in the water. Before I leave, I ask about the why now of Wendell's office renovation, of his beard. "What made you do all this?" I ask. "The beard," he says, "was the result of being out of the office and not needing to shave. When it was time to come back, he decided he liked it. As for the office makeover," he says simply, "it was time." "But why now?" I ask, trying to phrase my next question graciously. "It seems like you'd had that furniture for, a long while?" Wendell laughs. I didn't hide the subtext very well. "Sometimes," he says, "change is like that." Back in the waiting area, I move past the new modern-looking screen separating the exit from the seating. Outside, heat mirages rise on the sidewalk, and as I wait for the light, the Imagine Dragons song pops into my head again. I've been waiting to smile, eh? Been holding it in for a while. When the light turns green, I cross and head toward the parking lot. But today, I don't go straight to my car. I keep walking up the street until I'm in front of a glass storefront, a salon. I catch sight of myself in the window's reflection and stop to adjust my top, the one from Anthropology, which I'd chosen for tonight's date, and then hurry inside. I'm just in time for my appointment at the waxing place. Part 4. Though we travel the world over to find the beautiful, we must carry it with us, or we find it not. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Chapter 46. The Bees. A minute before Charlotte's appointment, I get a text from my mother. "Please call me." She doesn't normally send texts like this, so I dial her cell. She answers on the first ring. "Don't be alarmed," she says, which always means that something alarming has happened. "But Dad's in the hospital." My hand tenses on the phone. "He's fine," she says quickly. Fine people aren't admitted to the hospital, I think. "What happened?" I ask. "Well," she says, "they don't know yet." She explains that my father was eating lunch when he said he didn't feel well. Then he started shaking and had trouble breathing, and now they're at the hospital. It looks like he has an infection, but they don't know if it's related to his heart or something else. "He's fine," she keeps repeating. "He'll be fine." I think she says this as much for herself as for me. We both want, need, my father to be fine. "Really," she says, "he's fine. Here, see for yourself." I hear her mumble something to my father as she hands him the phone. "I'm fine," he says by way of hello. But I can hear his labored breathing. He tells me the same story about having lunch and not feeling well, leaving out the shaking and difficulty breathing parts. "He'll probably be out by tomorrow," he says, "once the antibiotics kick in." Though when my mom gets back on the phone, we wonder whether it's something more serious. Later that night, when I go to the hospital, I'll see that my father looks pregnant, his abdomen filled with fluid, and that he's on several different IV antibiotics because a serious bacterial infection has spread throughout his body. He will be hospitalized for a week, The fluid around his lungs aspirated. His heart rate stabilized. But right now, getting off the phone with my parents, I realize that I'm 12 minutes late for Charlotte's appointment. I try to shift focus as I head to the waiting room. Charlotte jumps up from her seat when I open the door. "Oh, phew," she says. "I thought maybe I had the wrong time. But this is always my time. And then I thought I had the wrong day, but no, it's Monday." She holds up her phone to show me the date. "So then I thought maybe, I don't know, but here you are." This all comes out as one long sentence. "Anyway, hi," she says, moving past me into my office. This may seem surprising, but when therapists are late, many patients are shaken. Though we try to avoid this, every therapist I know has let a patient down this way. And when we do, it can bring up old experiences of distrust or abandonment, leaving patients feeling anything from discombobulated to enraged. In my office, I explain that I was on an urgent phone call and apologize for the delay. "It's fine," Charlotte says nonchalantly. But she seems out of sorts. Or maybe I am after the call with my father. "I'm fine," he had said. "Just like Charlotte says it's fine." Are they both really fine? Charlotte fidgets in her chair, twirling her hair, looking around the room. I try to help her locate herself by meeting her eyes. But they're darting from the window to a picture on the wall, to the pillow she always keeps on her lap. One leg is crossed over the other, and she's rapidly kicking that leg in the air. "I wonder what it was like for you, not knowing where I was," I say, remembering how a few months ago, I'd been in the same position, sitting in Wendell's waiting room and wondering where he was. Killing time on my phone, I noticed that he was 4 minutes late, then 8. After 10 minutes, the thought crossed my mind that maybe he'd been in an accident or fallen ill and was at this moment in the emergency room. I debated whether to call and leave a message. To say what, I'm not sure. "Hi, it's Lori. I'm sitting in your waiting room. Are you in there? On the other side of the door, writing chart notes, eating a snack? Have you forgotten me, or are you dying?" And just as I was thinking about how I'd need to find a new therapist, in no small part to process my old therapist's death, the door to Wendell's office opened. Out walked a middle-aged couple, the man saying thank you to Wendell, and the woman smiling tightly. A first session, I speculated. Or the disclosure of an affair. Those sessions tend to run over. I breezed past Wendell and took my place perpendicular to him. "It's fine," I said when he apologized for the delay. "Really," I continued. "My sessions go over sometimes too. It's fine." Wendell looked at me, his right eyebrow raised. I raised my eyebrows back, trying to preserve my dignity. "Me? Get all worked up because my therapist was late? Come on." I burst out laughing, and then some tears escaped. We both knew how relieved I was to see him, and how important he had become to me. Those 10 minutes of waiting and wondering were definitely not fine. And now, with a forced smile on her face, her leg jerking like she's having a seizure, Charlotte is reiterating how fine it was to wait for me. I ask Charlotte what she thought had happened when I wasn't there. "I wasn't worried," she says, even though I said nothing about worry. Then something catches my eye through the large wall-to-wall window. Flying in dizzyingly fast circles a few feet behind the right side of Charlotte's head are a couple of very kinetic bumblebees. I've never seen bees out my window, several stories high, and these two look like they're hopped up on amphetamines. Maybe it's a bee mating dance, I think. But then a few more fly into view, and within seconds, I see a swarm of bees buzzing in circles, the only thing separating us from them being a huge sheet of glass. Some are starting to land on the window and crawl around. "So you're going to kill me," Charlotte begins, apparently unaware of the bees. "But, I'm going to take a break from therapy." I look away from the bees and back to Charlotte. I'm not expecting this today, and it takes a moment for what she just said to register, especially because there's so much movement in my peripheral vision and I can't help but follow it. Now there are hundreds of bees, so many that my office has become darker. The bees pressed up against the window panes and blocking out the light like a cloud. Where are they coming from? The room is so dark that Charlotte now notices. She turns her head in the direction of the window and we sit there, saying nothing, staring at the bees. I wonder if she'll be upset by the sight of them. But instead, she seems mesmerized. My colleague Mike used to see a family with a teenage girl at the same time I saw a couple. Every week, about 20 minutes in, this couple and I would hear an eruption from Mike's office. The teenager screaming at her parents, storming out, slamming the door. The couple yelling after her to come back, her yelling no, and then Mike coaxing her back, calming everyone down. The first few times this happened, I thought it would be upsetting for the couple in my office. But it turned out it made them feel better. At least that's not us, they thought. I'd hated the disturbance, though. It always broke my focus. And in the same way, I'm hating these bees. I think about my dad in the hospital, 10 blocks away. Are the bees a sign? An omen? I once thought about becoming a beekeeper, Charlotte says, breaking the silence. And this is less surprising to me than her sudden wish to leave. She finds terrifying situations thrilling. Bungee jumping, skydiving, swimming with sharks. As she tells me about her beekeeper fantasy, I think that the metaphor is almost too neat. This job that would require her to wear head-to-toe protective clothing so she wouldn't get stung and would allow her to master the very creatures that might hurt her, harvesting their sweetness in the end. I can see the appeal of having that kind of control over danger, especially if you grew up feeling like you had none. I can also imagine the appeal of saying you're leaving therapy if you were inexplicably left in the waiting room. Has Charlotte been planning to leave? Or is this an impulsive reaction to the primal fear she felt a few minutes ago? I wonder if she's drinking again. Sometimes people drop out of therapy because it makes them feel accountable when they don't want to be. If they've started drinking again or cheating again, if they've done or failed to do something that now causes them shame, they may prefer to hide from their therapists and themselves. What they forget is that therapy is one of the safest of all places to bring your shame. But faced with lying by omission or confronting their shame, they may duck out altogether, which, of course, solves nothing. I decided before I came in today, Charlotte says. I feel like I'm doing well. I'm still sober, work is going fine, I'm not fighting as much with my mom, and I'm not seeing the dude. I even blocked him on my phone. She pauses. Are you mad? Am I mad? I'm certainly surprised. I thought she'd moved past her fear of being addicted to me. And I'm frustrated, which I admit to myself is a euphemism for mad. But underneath the anger is the fact that I worry for her, perhaps more than I should. I worry that until she has had practice being in a healthy relationship, until she can find more peace with her dad than bouncing between pretending he doesn't exist and becoming devastated when he shows up and inevitably disappears again, she'll struggle and miss out on much of what she wants. I want her to work through this in her 20s rather than her 30s. I don't want her to squander her time. I don't want her to one day panic, "Half my life is over." And yet I also don't want to discourage her independence. Just as parents raise their kids to leave them one day, therapists work to lose patients, not retain them. Still, something feels rushed about this decision, and perhaps comfortably dangerous for her, like jumping out of a plane with no parachute. People imagine they come to therapy to uncover something from the past and talk it through. But so much of what therapists do is work in the present, where we bring awareness to what's going on in people's heads and hearts in the day-to-day. Are they easily injured? Do they often feel blamed? Do they avoid eye contact? Do they fixate on seemingly insignificant anxieties? We take these insights and encourage patients to practice making use of them in the real world. Wendell once put it this way. What people do in therapy is like shooting baskets against a backboard. It's necessary. But what they need to do then is go and play in an actual game. The one time Charlotte got close to having a real relationship, about a year into her therapy, she abruptly stopped seeing this guy, but refused to tell me why. Nor would she tell me why she didn't want to talk about it. I was less interested in what had happened than in what made this, of all the things she'd told me about herself, the thing that cannot be discussed. I wonder today, if she's leaving because of that thing. I remember how she'd wanted to hold on to this thing, to say no to my request. It's hard for me to say no, she explained. So I'm practicing in here. I told her that regardless of whether she talked about the breakup, I thought it was equally hard for her to say yes. The inability to say no is largely about approval seeking. People imagine that if they say no, they won't be loved by others. The inability to say yes, however, to intimacy, a job opportunity, an alcohol program, is more about lack of trust in oneself. Will I mess this up? Will this turn out badly? Isn't it safer to stay where I am? But there's a twist. Sometimes what seems like setting a boundary, saying no, is actually a cop-out, an inverted way of avoiding saying yes. The challenge for Charlotte is to get past her fear and say yes, not just to therapy, but to herself. I glance at the bees pressed up against the glass and think of my father again, and how once, when I was complaining about the way a relative would try to make me feel guilty, my father quipped, "Just because she sends you guilt doesn't mean you have to accept delivery." I think about this with Charlotte. I don't want her to feel guilty for leaving, to feel that she has let me down. All I can do is let her know that I'm here for her, either way. Share my perspective and hear hers, and set her free to do as she wishes. You know, I tell Charlotte, as I watch some of the bees begin to disperse, I agree that things are better in your life, and that you've worked hard to make that happen. I also have the sense that you're still struggling with getting close to people, and that the parts of your life that might be related to this, your dad, the conversation about the guy that you don't want to have, feel too painful to talk about. By not talking about them, part of you might believe that you can still hold out hope that things might be different. And you wouldn't be alone in that way of thinking. Some people hope that therapy will help them find a way to be heard by whoever they feel wronged them, at which point those lovers or relatives will see the light and become the people they'd wished for all along. But it rarely happens like that. At some point, being a fulfilled adult means taking responsibility for the course of your own life and accepting the fact that now you're in charge of your choices. You have to move to the front seat and be the mommy dog driving the car. Charlotte has been looking at her lap while I speak, but she sneaks a glance at me during that last part. The room is brighter now, and I notice that most of the bees have left. Just a few stragglers remain, some still on the glass, others circling each other before flying away. If you stay in therapy, I say softly, you might have to let go of the hope for a better childhood, but that's only so that you can create a better adulthood. Charlotte looks down for a long time, then says, I know. We sit together in the silence. Finally, she says, I slept with my neighbor. She's talking about a guy in her apartment building who had been flirting with her but also said that he wasn't looking for anything serious. She'd decided she was only going to date men who were looking for a girlfriend. She wanted to stop dating emotional versions of her dad. She wanted to stop being like her mom. She wanted to start saying no to those things, and yes to becoming neither parent, but instead the person she is yet to discover. I figured if I left therapy, I could just keep sleeping with him, she says. You can do whatever you want, I say, whether you're in therapy or not. I watch her hear what she already knows. Yes, she has given up drinking and the dude and has begun to give up the fight with her mom, too. But the stages of change are such that you don't drop all of your defenses at the same time. Instead, you release them in layers, moving closer and closer to the tender core. Your sadness, your shame. She shakes her head. I just don't want to wake up 5 years from now and never have had any kind of relationship, she says. 5 years from now, a lot of people my age won't be single anymore, and I'll be the girl who hooks up with a guy in the waiting room or her neighbor and then tells the story at a party like it's just another adventure, like I don't even care. The cool girl, I say. The one who has no needs or feelings and just goes with the flow. But you do have feelings. Yeah, she says. Being the cool girl feels like shit. She's never admitted this before. She's taking off her beekeeper suit. Is like shit a feeling? She asks. It sure is, I say. And so it begins, at last. Charlotte doesn't leave this time. Instead, she stays in therapy until she learns to drive her own car, navigating her way through the world more safely, looking both ways, making many wrong turns, but finding her way back, always, to where she truly wants to go. Chapter 47. Kenya. I'm getting a haircut and telling Corey my news about canceling my book contract with the publisher. I explain that now I might spend years repaying the publisher its money, and I might not be able to get another book contract after backing out of this one so late in the game, but I feel like an albatross has been removed from around my neck. Corey nods. I see him check out his tattooed biceps in the mirror. You know what I did this morning? He says. Hmm? I say. He combs out my front layers and checks that they're even. I watched a documentary on Kenyans who can't get clean water, he says. They're dying, and many of them are traumatized by war and sickness, and they're being thrown out of their homes and villages. They're wandering around just trying to find some water to drink that won't kill them. None of them go to therapy or owe their publishers money. He pauses. Anyway, that's what I did this morning. There's an awkward silence. Corey and I find each other's eyes in the mirror, and then slowly we begin to laugh. We're both laughing at me, and I'm laughing too at the ways people rank their pain. I think about Julie. At least I don't have cancer, she'd say. But that's also a phrase that healthy people use to minimize their own suffering. I remember how, initially, John's appointment was scheduled after Julie's, and how I regularly made an effort to remember one of the most important lessons from my training. There's no hierarchy of pain. Suffering shouldn't be ranked, because pain is not a contest. Spouses often forget this, upping the ante on their suffering. I had the kids all day. My job is more demanding than yours. I'm lonelier than you are. Whose pain wins or loses? But pain is pain. I'd done this myself, too. Apologizing to Wendell, embarrassed that I was making such a big deal about a breakup but not a divorce. Apologizing for suffering from anxiety about the very real financial and professional consequences of an unmet book contract, but that, nonetheless, were in no way as serious as the problems facing, well, the people in Kenya. I even apologized for talking about my health concerns, like when a patient noticed my tremor and I didn't know what to say. Because, after all, how bad was my suffering if I didn't even have a diagnosis, much less a diagnosis that ranked high on the acceptable problems to suffer from scale? I had an unidentified condition. I didn't, knock on wood, have Parkinson's. I didn't, knock on wood, have cancer. But Wendell told me that by diminishing my problems, I was judging myself and everyone else whose problems I had placed lower down on the hierarchy of pain. You can't get through your pain by diminishing it, he reminded me. You get through your pain by accepting it and figuring out what to do with it. You can't change what you're denying or minimizing. And of course, often what seem like trivial worries are manifestations of deeper ones. You still doing Tinder therapy? I ask Corey. He rubs some product into my hair. Hell yeah, he says. Chapter 48. Psychological immune system. Congratulations, you're not my mistress anymore, John says dryly as he walks in carrying a bag with our lunches. I wonder if this is his way of saying goodbye. Has he decided to stop therapy right when we've just genuinely begun? He walks to the couch and makes a show of silencing his cell phone before tossing it onto a chair. Then he opens the takeout bag and hands me my Chinese chicken salad. He reaches in again, pulls out some chopsticks, and holds them up. Want these? I nod. Thanks. Once we're settled, he looks at me expectantly, tapping his foot. Well, he says, don't you want to know why you're no longer my mistress? I look back at him. I'm not playing this game. Okay, fine, he sighs. I'll tell you. You're not my mistress anymore, because I came clean to Margot. She knows that I'm seeing you. He takes a bite of his salad, chews. And you know what she did? He continues. I shake my head. She got mad. Why would you keep this a secret? How long has this been going on? What's her name? Who else knows? You'd think you and I were fucking or something, right? John laughs to make sure I know how outlandish he considers that possibility. To her, it might feel like that, I say. Margot feels left out of your life, and now she's hearing that you've been sharing it with somebody else. She craves that closeness with you. Yeah, John says, and he seems lost in thought for a bit. He takes more bites of his salad, looks at the floor, then rubs his forehead as if whatever's going on in there is draining him. Finally, he looks up. We talked about Gabe, he says quietly. And then he starts crying. A guttural wail, raw and wild. And I recognize it instantly. It's the sound I heard in the ER back in medical school, from the parents of the drowned toddler. It's a love song to his beloved son. I have a flash to another ER, on the night when my son was a year old, and he had to be rushed by ambulance to the hospital after he spiked a fever of 104 and began seizing. By the time the paramedics arrived at my house, his body was limp, his eyes closed, and he was unresponsive to my voice. As I sit with John, I feel again in my body the terror of seeing my son lifeless. Me on the gurney with him on my torso, the EMTs flanking us, the sirens a surreal soundtrack. I hear the sound of him howling for me as they strapped him into the X-ray contraption, forcing him to be still. His eyes open now, terrified, beseeching me to hold him as he squirmed violently to reach me. His screams, in their intensity, sounded much like John's wail now. Somewhere in the hospital's hallway, I remember seeing what looked like an unconscious child, or a dead one, being wheeled by. This could be us, I thought at that moment. This could be us by the morning. We could be leaving here like this too. But it wasn't us. I got to go home with my beautiful boy. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so, so sorry, John is saying through his tears. And I don't know if he's apologizing to Gabe or Margot or his mother, or to me for his outburst. All of the above, he says. But mostly he's sorry that he can't remember. He wanted to block out the unfathomable. The accident, the hospital, the moment he learned that Gabe had died. But he couldn't. What he'd give to forget hugging his son's dead body. Margot's brother pulling them both away, and John punching him, screaming, I will not leave my son. How he'd like to erase the scene of telling his daughter that her brother had died, and of the family's arrival at the cemetery, Margot falling to the ground, unable to walk in. But those memories, unfortunately, remain vividly intact, the stuff of his waking nightmares. What's fuzzier, he says, are the happy memories. Gabe in his twin bed in his Batman pajamas. Snuggle me, Dada. Rolling around in wrapping paper after opening his birthday presents. The way Gabe strode confidently into his preschool class like a big kid, only to turn around at the door and blow a furtive kiss. The sound of his voice. I love you to the moon and back. The smell of his head when John bent down to kiss him. The music of his giggle. His animated facial expressions. His favorite food or animal or color. Was it blue or rainbow before he died? All of these memories feel to John as if they're fading into the distance. That he's losing the details of Gabe, much as he wants to hold on to them. All parents forget these details about their kids as they grow. And they mourn that loss too. The difference is that as the past recedes in their memories, the present is right in front of them. For John, the loss of his memories brings him closer to the loss of Gabe. And so at night, John tells me, while Margot seethes, assuming that he's working or watching porn, he's hiding out with his laptop watching videos of Gabe, thinking about how these are the only videos he'll ever have of his son, just as the memories John has of Gabe are the only memories he'll ever have. There will be no more memories made. And while the memories might get blurry, the videos won't. John says that he's watched these videos hundreds of times and can no longer tell the difference between his actual memories and the videos. He watches obsessively, though, to keep Gabe alive in my mind. Keeping him alive in your mind is your way of not abandoning him, I say. John nods. He says that he pictures Gabe alive all the time. What he would look like, how tall he would be, what interests he'd have. He still sees the neighbor boys who were Gabe's friends as toddlers and imagines Gabe hanging out with them now in middle school, having crushes on girls, eventually shaving. He also imagines the possibility that Gabe would have gone through a phase of butting up against John. And when John hears other parents complain about their high schoolers, he thinks about what a luxury it would be to have the chance to nag Gabe about his homework, or find weed in his room, or catch him doing any of the pain-in-the-ass things that teens tend to do. He'll never get to meet his son the way other parents meet their kids at different stages along the way, when they're the same people they've always been, but both thrillingly and sadly different. What did you and Margot talk about? I ask. When Margot was interrogating me about therapy, he says. She wanted to know why I was here. Was it about Gabe? Did I talk about Gabe? And I told her that I didn't come to therapy to talk about Gabe. I was just stressed out. But she wouldn't let it go. She was incredulous. So you haven't talked about Gabe at all? I told her that what I talked about was private. I mean, can I talk about what I want in my own therapy? What is she, the therapy police? Why do you suppose it's important to her that you talk about Gabe? He considers this. I remember after Gabe died. Margot wanted me to talk about Gabe and I just couldn't. She didn't understand how I could go to barbecues and Lakers games and seem like a normal person. But that first year I was in shock. Numb. I told myself, keep moving, don't stop. But the next year, when I woke up, I'd want to die. I kept my game face on, but I was bleeding internally, you know? I wanted to be strong for Margot and Gracie, and I had to keep a roof over our heads, so I couldn't let anyone see the bleeding. Then Margot wanted another baby, and I said, fuck it, okay. I mean, Jesus. I was in no shape to be a new father. But Margot was adamant that she didn't want Gracie to grow up alone. It wasn't just that we had lost a child. Gracie had lost her only sibling. And the house did seem different than it had when we had two kids running around. It didn't feel like a kid house anymore. The stillness was a reminder of what was missing. John sits forward, puts the cover on a salad, tosses it across the room into the trash bin. Swish. It always goes right in. Anyway, he says, the pregnancy seemed to be good for Margot. It brought her back to life. But not me. I kept thinking that nobody could replace Gabe. Besides, what if I killed this one too? John told me that when he first heard that his mother had died, he was sure he had killed her. Before she'd left to go to rehearsal that night, he'd begged her to rush home so she'd be there in time to tuck him in. She must have died rushing home in her car, he thought. Of course, his father told him that she died while trying to push one of her students out of harm's way. But John was certain this was a cover story to protect his feelings. It wasn't until he saw the headline in the local paper, he had just learned to read, that he knew it was true. He hadn't killed his mother. But he also knew that she would have died for him in a heartbeat, just like he would have done for Gabe or Gracie, and just as he would now for Ruby. But would he do it for Margot? He's not so sure. Would she do it for him? He's not sure either. John pauses, then quips to break the tension. Wow, this is getting heavy. I think I'll lie down. He stretches out on the couch, tries to fluff a pillow behind his head, and makes a disgruntled sound. What's this filled with, cardboard? He once complained. In a weird way, he continues. I was worried I might love the new baby too much, like I'd be betraying Gabe. I was so glad it wasn't another boy. I didn't think I could handle a baby boy without him reminding me of Gabe. What if he liked the same fire trucks that Gabe did? Everything would be an agonizing memory. And that would be unfair to the kid. I was so worried about this that I did research on when to have sex so you had the best chance of a girl. It was on the show. I nod. It was in a subplot with a couple who were later written out. Season 3, I think. They were always having sex at the wrong time because one or the other of them couldn't control themselves and wait. I remember how funny it was. I had no sense of the pain that inspired it. The point, John says, is that I didn't tell Margot. I just made sure to have sex only on the day that we'd have the best chance of a girl. Then I sweated it out until the ultrasound. When the OB said it looked like a girl, Margot and I both said, "Are you sure?" Margot wanted a boy because she loved raising a boy, and we already had a girl. So she was disappointed that first night. "I'll never get to raise a boy again," she said. But I was fucking ecstatic. I felt like I could be a better father to a girl, under the circumstances. And then when Ruby was born, I thought I'd shit my pants. The second I saw her, I fell madly in love. John's voice catches and he stops. "What happened to your grief then?" I ask. "Well, it got better at first, which, in a strange way, made me feel worse." "Because the grief had connected you to Gabe?" John looks surprised. "Not bad, Sherlock." "Yeah. It was almost like my pain was evidence of my love for Gabe. And if I let up, it meant I was forgetting about him, that he didn't matter as much to me.
That if you were happy, you couldn't also be sad."
"Exactly." He looks away. "I still feel that way."
"What if it's both?" I say. "What if your sadness, your grief, is what allowed you to love Ruby with so much joy when you first saw her?"
I remember a woman I treated whose husband had died. When she fell in love a year later, a love all the more sweet because of the loss of her husband, she worried that others would judge her.
"So soon? Didn't you love your husband of 30 years?
In fact, her friends and family were excited for her. It wasn't their judgment she was hearing. It was her own. What if her happiness was an insult to her husband's memory? It took her a while to see that her happiness didn't diminish her love for her husband. It honored it. John tells me he finds it ironic that Margot used to be the one who wanted to talk about Gabe, and John couldn't. Later, if John made a rare reference to Gabe, Margot would get upset. Would their family always be haunted by this tragedy? Would his marriage? Maybe we remind each other of what happened, like our mere presence is some kind of sick memento, John says. What we need, he adds, looking up at me, is some kind of closure.
Ah, closure.
I know what John means, and yet I've always thought that closure was an illusion of sorts. Many people don't know that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's familiar stages of grieving, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, were conceived in the context of terminally ill patients learning to accept their own deaths. It wasn't until decades later that the model came to be used for the grieving process more generally. It's one thing to accept the end of your own life, as Julie is struggling to do. But for those who keep on living, the idea that they should be getting to acceptance might make them feel worse. "I should be past this by now. I don't know why I still cry at random times all these years later. Besides, how can there be an endpoint to love and loss? Do we even want there to be? The price of loving so deeply is feeling so deeply. But it's also a gift, the gift of being alive. If we no longer feel, we should be grieving our own deaths." The grief psychologist, William Warden, takes into account these questions by replacing stages with tasks of mourning. In his fourth task, the goal is to integrate the loss into your life and create an ongoing connection with the person who died, while also finding a way to continue living. But many people come to therapy seeking closure. "Help me not to feel." What they eventually discover is that you can't mute one emotion without muting the others. You want to mute the pain? You'll also mute the joy. You're both so alone in your grief, I say, and in your joy. In our sessions, John has dropped occasional hints of his joy. His two girls, his dog, Rosie, writing a killer show, winning another Emmy, a boys' trip with his brothers. Sometimes, John says, he can't believe that he's capable of feeling joy. After Gabe died, he thought he'd never live through it. He'd go on, he figured, but like a ghost. And yet, just a week after Gabe's death, he and Gracie were playing together. And for a second, maybe two, he felt okay. He smiled and laughed with her. And the fact that he laughed amazed him. Just 1 week ago, his son had died. Was that sound really coming from him? I tell John about what's known as the psychological immune system. Just as your physiological immune system helps your body recover from physical attack, your brain helps you recover from psychological attack. A series of studies by the researcher Daniel Gilbert at Harvard found that in responding to challenging life events, from the devastating, becoming handicapped, losing a loved one, to the difficult, a divorce, an illness, people do better than they anticipate. They believe that they'll never laugh again, but they do. They think they'll never love again, but they do. They do grocery shopping and see movies. They have sex and dance at weddings. They overeat on Thanksgiving and go on diets in the new year. The day-to-day returns. John's reaction while playing with Grace wasn't unusual. It was the norm. There's another related concept that I share with John. Impermanence. Sometimes in their pain, people believe that the agony will last forever. But feelings are actually more like weather systems. They blow in and they blow out. Just because you feel sad this minute or this hour or this day doesn't mean you'll feel that way in 10 minutes or this afternoon or next week. Everything you feel, anxiety, elation, anguish, blows in and out again. For John, on Gabe's birthday, on certain holidays, or simply running in the background, there will always be pain. Hearing a certain song in the car or having a fleeting memory might even plunge him into momentary despair. But another song, or another memory, might minutes or hours later bring intense joy. Where, I wonder, is John's shared joy with Margot? I ask him what he imagines would have happened with Margot had the car crash not happened. What would their marriage be like today? Oh, for God's sake, he says. Now you think I can rewrite history? He looks out the window, at the clock, at his sneakers, which he had slipped off when he lay down on the couch. Finally, he looks at me. Actually, I think about that a lot lately, he says. Sometimes I think about how we were a young family, and my career was taking off, and Margot was taking care of the kids and trying to run a business, and how we'd lost touch with each other, the way people do at that stage of life. I think about how things might have changed once both kids were in school and we were farther ahead in our careers. You know, life would normalize. But maybe it wouldn't have. I used to be so sure that she was the right person for me, and I was the right person for her. But we make each other so unhappy, and I don't even remember when that started. Everything I do is wrong in her eyes. Maybe we would have been divorced by now. People say that marriages fall apart after a child's death. But maybe we stayed together because of what happened to Gabe. He laughs. Maybe Gabe saved our marriage. Maybe, I say. Or, maybe you stayed together because you both want to rediscover the parts of yourselves that seem to have died along with Gabe. Maybe you both believe you can find each other again. Or, for the first time. I think about the family of the drowned toddler in the ER. What are they doing right now? Did they have another child? Their baby. The one whose diaper was being changed while their three-year-old ran outside and drowned, would now be in college. Maybe that couple is long divorced and living with their new spouses. Or maybe they're still together, stronger than ever. Perhaps taking a hike on the scenic trails near their home on a peninsula south of San Francisco, reminiscing about the past, remembering their beloved daughter. "It's funny," John says. "I guess we're finally both ready to talk about Gabe at the same time. And now that we are, I feel better. I mean, I also feel like shit. But it's okay, if you know what I mean. It's not as bad as I thought it would be. It's not as bad as it was not talking about Gabe," I suggest. "Like I said, you're good, sure." We share a smile. He stopped himself from calling me Sherlock, from using the caricature as a spacekeeper between us. Letting Gabe become more real in his life is allowing him to let others be more real, too. John sits up and starts fidgeting. Our session is about to end. As he slips on his sneakers and stands to retrieve his phone, I think back to his earlier comment about telling Margot he came to therapy due to stress, and how often he's told me the same thing. "John," I say, "do you really think you came here because of stress?"
"What are you, an idiot?"
he says, a twinkle in his eye.
"I came here to talk about Margot and Gabe."
"Boy, are you dim sometimes." When he leaves, there's no wad of cash at the door for his hooker.
"You can bill me," he says. "No more skulking around. We're legit now."
Chapter 49. Counseling versus therapy. "Are you asking for counseling or therapy?" Wendell says at today's session, after I tell him that I have a professional question. He knows I'll understand the distinction, because he's offered professional guidance